wanted to wake Bill up. This is a workshop on sponsorship, sponsored by the North County Central Office. The questions that were handed out to you are not significant at all, except that they are questions that are asked a great deal around the fellowship and in the fellowship. Some of them are important, and some of them probably are not important at all. They don't constitute a format for the meeting or anything like that. They were simply put out as a means of kind of jogging people's mind about sponsorship. You might use the questions listening to the speakers, applying them where they fit, or you might want to bring them up in the discussion. The format of the meeting has been designed to go as follows. We'll have the two speakers will speak each between 30 and 40 minutes. Then, without a coffee break, each table will constitute, each number table and non-number table will constitute a discussion group with a facilitator who just kind of, in other words, then we want everyone at this meeting to share your opinions, your questions with one another. That will be about another half an hour. That will leave about, depending, you know, between 15 minutes and a half an hour for if there is anything about in the discussion that you have with your discussion group that just seems insoluble or a question that was really wanted to ask either of the speakers or any of the old timers in the room, then you would be expected for your facilitator that you pick to come up to the mic and ask the question after the discussion period. It is my intention that the meeting should end at 3:30. If anyone has to leave before that, well, then they'll have to leave. But I would think 2 hours in a stuffy room would be enough for anyone, but we'll see what happens then. But I had figured the meeting to go until 3:30. Would you join me in the serenity prayer, please? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Sponsorship, there's about 260 people in the room. I imagine if it's like anything else in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are 260 opinions about sponsorship. And that's what a sharing session is all about. A kid who got a 90-day token the other night described his sponsor as his fixed point. And that terminology fascinated me. It's a navigational term, and I thought it was a rather interesting way to put it. There's the term a fixed point also is kind of interesting, that sometimes geese or ducks have they're born, the first thing they see becomes their mother, and they imitate that. And I think perhaps if you reflect, your ideas about sponsorship probably have to do with how you were sponsored when you came into this fellowship. I know mine are. So keep that in mind, and the idea is in the sharing today is to be open-minded. Not that anyone's going to change their mind about anything. Perhaps you will, perhaps you won't, but that's certainly not the intention here. It's simply to share ideas. Now, there are two separate, probably distinct groups here, at least today. One group are people who are being thrust into sponsorship, whether they want it or not. People are asking them to sponsor, and they're worried about that, and they don't know if they can do it. And then there are other people who are here today, I know, who are getting ready to be sponsored, and of which is the most painful, I don't know, really. But that's roughly the kinds of people here today. And so you, of course, in your discussion groups, will want to share, you know, identify which side of the fence you're on right here today. We have two, I would not guess that anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous could you find two people better qualified to speak in the area of sponsorship. Both of them have certainly done their share. I asked Sybil whether she wanted to speak first or second, because the sponsorship I was raised in, seniority counts. And so Sybil decided she'd like to go second, so if there's any insults, she can protect herself. For those of you who've been in Mongolia somewhere who don't know Sybil. Sybil has the longest sobriety of any woman in Alcoholics Anonymous in California, and perhaps second in the United States, I don't know. But our first speaker is has sponsored perhaps half the known world. He has always been a fixed point for me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because he walks like he talks. Clancy I.
My name is Clancy Imslin, and I'm an alcoholic. Let me establish one thing first, because Sybil was too gracious to say it. Sybil has the longest sobriety of any woman in Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. And now I'll discuss quality sobriety. For quantity until I get next to someone like Sybil, and I start talking about quality. But I am very pleased to be here. I'm very pleased to be in the same program with Sybil. She was in charge of the central office when I got sober in the 1950s. And at that time, she was already a well thought of and highly esteemed old timer, and I've seen nothing in her life since then, with the possible exception of one bad marriage, to change that. I thought you were sick in bed, Bob. But sponsorship is a well thought of thing in Alcoholics Anonymous in the abstract. Everybody believes in sponsorship, sometimes for someone else. But everyone believes in sponsorship in the abstract, and many people believe in it because of their own personal experience. I've had a number of experiences with sponsors. I have had a number of experiences with people I have sponsored. I know, for example, that in many areas of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to be as objective about this as possible, I am held out as a threat to recalcitrant newcomers. If you don't shape up, we're going to send you that goddamn Clancy. Because there's a feeling that I don't know what they feel. If we flog them around the fleet in our group, we have a whim of iron. And the reason for that, I suppose, reflects part of my experience in that in my slipping around AA, I use sponsors primarily to either be reflected by whatever prestige they might have, or so I could have a sponsor. Someone said, do you have a sponsor? Or to use them for money, property, and prestige, or to help me get a job, or whatever I could do. And it was only when I got to a point where I couldn't get a sponsor who loved me unconditionally that things got terrible and I had to stay sober. I've said this story many, many times, but I'll say it one more time. There's no any better way to describe it. To me, a sponsor was always a person that you try to get, and then you don't talk to. Maybe just, well, for instance, in Dallas, I asked a pediatrician to be my sponsor because we had a lot of small children who were sick a lot. You know, just it's not an all-out good reason, but it made a few bucks. In El Paso, I had the Sunday editor of the El Paso Times because I was working and I needed to get stories in that El Paso Times. I've always had people that I thought I could use a little bit. And there's nothing wrong with that, I suppose, if that's what you want. But if you want sobriety, it might not work as well. But I You know, a sponsor was a person I... If I had anything unpleasant to talk about, I wouldn't talk to, or unless I needed something. I didn't want to just expose myself to anybody. And I, you know, a sponsor is a person who usually I would wind up calling at 2 o'clock in the morning. And say, "Hello, Jim. I'm afraid I've let you and AA down." And if you had a, if I had a decent sponsor, he would say, "No, you haven't let us down. You're not bad. You're sick. You had a relapse, that's all. Don't feel bad. I'm coming right over there. We're going to work this out together. You need money? Let me know if you need money. I'll get a pint so you won't go into a DT's." And, you know. Now, that's what I call sponsorship. And unfortunately, I am by nature a user and a manipulator. I know that because I didn't realize for a sober while how bad I have done in that area. It goes back, I suppose, to when I was 11 or 12, the best evidence of that, when my parents got divorced. I was raised in a very strict church, and I had never known of a divorce in my life at the age of 11 or 12. I had never seen a divorce. I knew they existed somewhere, but I knew nothing about them. Till my own parents got a divorce, and it was the shock in the family. It was like, you know, somebody had come home with a tertiary syphilis or something. Just nobody ever talked about it. And my parents separated. And I had never seen a divorce, knew nothing about divorce, had no friends who had been around a divorce. And yet I instinctively, without a word, without any training, without any background, instinctively handled it as badly as it's possible to handle it. I began to play my mother against my father to avoid responsibility. And I never even thought about it. But I would stay with my mother till the heat came down, and I'd go and stay with my father and tell him stories about her and how what she had said about him. And then when the heat came down there, I would go back to my mother and say, "Mother, I'm sorry, but Dad is just impossible, and he says these things about you." And when they both got together occasionally, I'd go to my grandmother and tell her story about both of them. And I thought that was... I just thought I was doing the best I could. But what I had done, what I did, I suppose I did, I must have paid for that. I must be still paying for that to an extent, because I ruined... When I came into puberty, when I should have been in some kind of a structure, I had avoided structure. And by the time I was 15, I was so screwed up, I ran away to sea early in the Second World War. And from then on, it was just payday on the ranch all the time, because I had never had a structure. But I have always been... I suppose it gets back to a basic feeling of insecurity somehow. But when you have a basic feeling of insecurity, you have to continue to manipulate, because if you take things as they are, you won't be enough. You have to have an edge. It's the old alcoholic edge. I gotta be treated special to feel average. When I'm treated average, I feel rejected, because I have no reinforcement inside, so I gotta get more on the outside. And sponsorship to me was a surrogate father figure sometimes, and I would manipulate him like my father, or try to. And I was very unsuccessful. And I, at the end of many years of slipping around AA, I came to AA one more time, and I got into Los Angeles, where they were strong in sponsorship of the AA club called the 6300 Club, and I got an old guy who I kind of had some feeling of chemistry for, and he was very strong on me. And I found out later he didn't like me. He was trying to run me off, in a sense. But it's a funny thing I think about that now. A guy that he sponsored that he did like told me that he used to get my call sometimes and put his hand over his phone and say, "This crazy son of a bitch, I wish you'd go tell it to somebody else." And until he heard the voice stop saying it. And he said, "Boy, he just put you down." But the odd thing was, by that time, something had changed. I want to talk to you a little bit about that. First of all, he had begun by saying something to the effect that he didn't know what I had done up till then, but don't ever call him when I was drinking. Don't ever call him when he was drinking. He says, "If you ever call me when you're drinking, All they're going to hear is a click and a dial tone. That's all they're going to hear. I don't talk to drunks. Which I thought was cold and cruel. I tried to get some money from him. I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot just to get a start. I had been an award-winning writer. I'd directed a grand opera. I'd done all sorts of things. And I'd had my front teeth kicked out so I couldn't really clearly tell people about what I had done. Because not a lot of things happened in the 50s, and you can't say 50 or nothing. And I said to him, you know, I'm cold and hungry, and a lot of days I'm just living on cake at those meetings. What am I going to do? And he said, get a job. And I said, look how terrible I look. And he said, get a terrible job. You know, only he didn't say it as nicely as I just said it. Get a terrible job. And I had a tremendous love-hate relationship for him. Remember, one thing I was never going to do was I was never going to take a fourth step because I'd been in psychoanalysis. If I did take a fourth step, it would be a highly edited fourth step, or it would be a very circumscribed, because a lot of the things, I wouldn't even tell the truth to my psychiatrist, you know, because I've never really felt that other people have had the aberrant emotions I have been cursed with. I didn't at that time, at any rate. Now I realize I was just a pussycat compared to you sickies. But I wouldn't tell my psychiatrist how I felt. I just knew he'd say, get out of my office, you sick son of a bitch. So I just told him what I thought he would need to know to help me. And apparently he didn't know enough. And writing an inventory, a fearless and searching moral inventory, I had done some things that were... It's a funny thing. The really dreadful sounding things weren't the things I was ashamed of. It was the petty, little, nasty, cruddy little things where there's no justifiable... You know, it's easy to talk about jails and nut houses and hospitals. I did this. It's the little, petty, nasty things where there's no justification except your own inadequacy and your own lack of character. Nobody wants to put that down. That's crappy. So one day I was, when I was about 6 months sober, I got fired as a dishwasher at the Gaiety Delicatessen. I don't mean to imply I'd been there 6 months. I'd been there 2.5 days or 2 days. And I've told this story many times, but I have always had just a hint of paranoia. And, I'm glad it went away before I came down here. I remember working in that restaurant, and I was washing dishes, and I wouldn't justify it today, but at that time, it seemed that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than that restaurant was using. Which led me to believe these bastards are going to other restaurants and bringing in dishes. Which wouldn't have surprised me, because that's where much of my life has gone. The continual pain and discrimination. So I just made a pile of their dishes and didn't do them, and I did what I conceived to be our dishes. And of course, I got fired. And I felt so bad about that, I was going to commit suicide. I'd committed suicide once before. 2 or 3 years before that, successfully. In fact, a guy next door found my body dead and beat on my chest and got my heart started again and got me living again in the front seat of a car where I'd had the motor going. Thank God he got there when he did. Because you only have about 2 minutes when that happens, when the brain stops. And I was going to commit suicide, but it's a funny thing. I never thought about this, but I've heard a lot of alcoholics talk about it in AA. I don't mind dying, but I don't want to hurt. You got to find a manner of suicide that it won't be painful. You know, it's the old thing again, we talk about in the service. Would you rather be shot in the head or shot in the stomach and die? Everybody should be rather shot in the head because it's quick. In the stomach, you get pain. Most people like me have a very low threshold of pain. And I don't want to hurt. Kill me if you must, but do it quick. Do it decently. And I wanted to die, but I didn't want to hurt. So I had just seen on the television on the AA club upstairs of the meeting hall a thing on, I had seen an old rerun of A Star Is Born, where at the end Frederick March walked in the ocean, and everybody else was sorry. So I decided to walk in the ocean that day, and I didn't know quite how to get there direct. I had to come back to La Cienega and over to Wilshire, and then... And I walked and walked and walked and walked and walked. And tears of self-pity were welling in my... I could hardly see the lights in it. Because when you're in that kind of a situation, not only do you feel bad, but there's another part of you that keeps saying, you poor sumbitch, you poor... You're so noble and good. And I couldn't find the ocean. I got to... I finally stopped at the gas station. I said, where's the ocean? And he says, you're just on the western end of Beverly Hills, kid. You have to keep going out past the Veterans Hospital. There was no San Diego freeway then. He said, and then about another 6 miles or 5 miles. I said, I don't mind dying. I'm going to walk myself to death. This is nonsense. And I'd walked into my sponsor's toll zone. I didn't want to blow 15 cents on calling them, but I don't mind a dime. And I called them, and I remember thinking, I want to tell him the saddest story I could, because he's such a cold thing. But I wanted just once, maybe he'll evince some humanity if I make him some sad story that really... I said, Bob, this Clancy, yeah. And he's, you know, before you say anything, you know, I lost that job as a dishwasher. Mike Ross got me. It wasn't my fault, but let me tell you something, Bob, before you get upset. You know, I was thinking, Bob, I've been taking a long walk, and I don't really have any friends, Bob. I've been sober 6 months. I've been going to meetings every night just about. Nobody really likes me. People warn their babies against me. Now, I look terrible. I got front teeth. I'm skinny. I got old clothes that don't fit. My parents have ripped me off. I'm an only child. I'll never see my children again. But most importantly, I have nobody who cares whether I live or die. I'm just alone in the world, Bob. I can't ever come back. And as I was saying that, it suddenly struck me. This is true. The worst story I could think of was my case. And I had a moment of truth. I burst into tears of self-pity. So I said, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? She says, why don't you do what I told you? Write your goddamn inventory. And that, I thought to myself, why don't you? I don't know what it was I wanted him to do, but it would have been fun to watch him try it. I said, in my judgment, Bob, that's the last thing in the world I need. I'm cursed with remorse and regret. He says, and your judgment. Who cares about your stinking judgment? If I wanted your judgment, I'd go down to that abandoned car and I'd stick my head in the window and ask you for it. But I live in a $200,000 house. Why should I care about your goddamn judgment? And I just got so upset, I just... terrible way to treat a newcomer. If I'd had the money, I'd have called the New York office, the World Service office, and I'd have turned that old fool in. I would have... just want you to know there's a man out here killing newcomers. Signed, a friend. That, as I've said many times, it's funny how the world turns. Now, when I talk to the World Service Office, I find myself saying, no, I'm not. But he said, you got to turn off your damn judgment. Your judgment stinks, and the sicker you get, the worse it looks. You got to turn off your judgment. And then that conversation, a long conversation, I wrote an inventory that day in absolute craziness. I was so upset I didn't edit it or go leave out things and wish I wasn't a hero. And that was a great turning spot in my life, because I suppose that day, in a sense, I took the third step of AA for the first time. I've had to take it again and again since. I envy those people who can take the third step and just make it last. I'm more sensitive. And in a sense, I suppose, for that reason and other reasons, most of my sobriety, most of the sponsorship I have been involved in, have been with people who are slippers, who have had a lot of problems. I usually work with people who are slippers or have a lot of problems. In fact, I just thought about that when I came down today. Four of us came down in the car, and the other three of all came to my office, been slipping and slipping and slipping, and they came to me not because they wanted my sponsorship, because they wanted to stay sober, and somehow they'd have to put up with me to do it. Not me, Clancy Emerson, but an activist approach to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I know, and it says in our book and in our pamphlets, that everyone responds differently to sponsorship, and everyone has a different approach to sponsorship. When I was new and a firebrand in my first 2 or 3 years, I had no patience or tolerance of anyone who did it differently than I did, or wanted to do it differently, and I just wrote them off. As the years have gone by, I've become more mellow. It's like the old thing in this Bible that says, "In my Father's house are many mansions." But I am still firmly convinced that there is no better, surer way than being an active, involved member of Alcoholics Anonymous and actively pursuing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, but more importantly, in my opinion, to breaking down the veneer that alienates me from people. Because no matter how we all look or how we all sound, it is my firm conviction that we are all by nature loners. When you get down deep enough, we are loners. Some people have more glib facades and more clever ways to get along, and they seem so fine. But where the rubber meets the road at 2 o'clock in the morning, we are loners, basically. And so we have to do everything we can to open up some apertures into that last bastion of loneliness that, left to its own devices, will distort my entire perception of the world for a given moment or an hour or a day or a week. And as we all know, the effect of alcohol on people like you and me is to alter my perception of reality to make it less untenable. If I cannot find a way to make it less untenable sober, I will have to do it chemically. That's the nature of the disease of alcoholism. That's why people like you and me, you know, we could continually and interminably, when we're mucking around, compare, well, I didn't go to jail or didn't go to the nut house or didn't do this and that. That has nothing to do with it. The thing is, alcohol has to have a special effect on me. It must do something for me that it doesn't do for 94% of the bodies in the world. It must literally alter my perception of reality. And there's only one time that becomes obsessive, and that is when I can no longer stand reality as it is. In fact, scientists who study alcoholics say that sobered up or dried out alcoholics can get to a point where they literally must drink to preserve their sanity. Now, that's an extreme case, but that's certainly true. We talk about alcoholism being the second greatest cause of insanity. They're not talking about insanity from worry. They're talking about insanity when you've drunk enough alcohol to avoid reality. It eventually desiccates or dries out your brain cells in much the same manner that tertiary syphilis does. And when you have alcoholic insanity, you're not acting silly in the meetings. You're sitting on a porch somewhere and they're coming and changing your diapers. You don't see them. Most people never see a case of alcoholic insanity, because by the time you got it, you're out of sight.
Turn the tape.
That's what they're talking about, not concern and worry and anxiety. These are the neurotic tendencies that push us to the edge of either having to change or to do something about it. And that, in a sense, is the great value of sponsorship for people. Now, I know that there are, as I say, many different ways to do it. But, in my opinion, there has to be a way for me and a way for you. I'm an intense manipulator that, without even being aware of it, needed a structure badly. I work with people mostly who are intense, neurotic people who need a structure badly and don't even know it. I am not sick with pleasure watching people drop off people in my office or my home and drive away. On occasions, before I worked at the mission, now it's a gathering spot by the bus depot, and they come under a bus station. But I remember at my home, 1 o'clock in the morning on a couple different occasions, doorbell is rung, and I've gone to the door, and there's some fool standing there. They said you'd help me. And I said, who said you'd help me? I'd help you. And they point, and across the park is a car speeding away at top speed. I said, did he tell you his name? No, he wouldn't tell me his name. I tried to get physical description. I'd dust the guy for prints just in... But I have discovered that one of the great helps I've ever had in sobriety is sponsorship. Primarily because my introversion is so great, I need all the help I can to focus that outward. I know that I have erred many times in sponsorship because I've many times become too involved. I've tried to work in the extremes, but I have tried to place myself where that person is. It's very easy to understand people if you can project yourself to where, as they're seeing things. If you expect them to see things the way you're seeing them because you just explained it for half an hour, it doesn't do any good. You got to understand. Probably the greatest help in sponsorship, at least for intense, difficult cases, and it's just dreadful to say, but it's really true. There has to be that kind of spark of mystique or something that when you say, it's going to be all right if you do this, if they believe it's going to be all right, you've got a winner, at least for that day. I'll tell you one of the oddities, Bill knows about it, and Cliff and some of the other guys, one of the great examples of that. About 8 years ago, there's a woman in our group who was really, she had anorexia nervosa and weighed about 70 pounds and just almost as tall as I am. She came from New York, was on her way to Tibet for the ultimate answer. And some goof stopped her and brought her to our meeting. And nobody wanted to touch her with a 10-foot pole. And some woman brought over and said, here's a 10-foot pole or a 6-foot pole. And she started to get better. I used to just, she was a good working spot for me because she was such a mope. You couldn't do anything wrong with her. I used to drop by her little room that we got her in. And I'd say, eat those potatoes!
I can't.
Eat the goddamn potatoes! Nobody was around to discuss my methods of sponsorship. So anyway, she put on about 30 pounds, which brought her up to start, looked like a Dachau inmate. And we sent her to have her teeth fixed. All she had was some stumps and fangs. God, she was a mess. And the doctor says, you've got a little redness in your throat. You better go downstairs and check. And so she went downstairs and checked. Said, UCLA, it's free. They said, you have advanced throat cancer. And you better be operated on tomorrow. And they put me down. She put me down for next of kin. Just a true mope. I don't mean because of that. But she was just a unbelievable. She had, her parents had written her off. Everybody had written her off. And so she was rushed into surgery. I remember sitting outside of the surgery, and they took out her throat, her voice box, and everything. And I went in to see her. I couldn't hardly bear it because she tubes running out all over in that big hole in her throat and dying. And the doctor said, she's got cancer all over her, in the lymph nodes, in her breast, everywhere. At best, we can give her 3 weeks. And I talked to her and held her hand. And I said, Sandra, she couldn't talk. And I said, listen,
You're very sick, but now you're 6 months sober. I tell you, it's going to be all right. You just got to do everything they say and eat everything and do all these things. You're going to put you in chemotherapy, which won't even make your hair fall out. It'll just make you better. And she had tears of gratitude. And she went into chemotherapy. None of her hair fell out. Very astonishing to me. I said, I'm a son of a bitch. I didn't have the faith she had. And she got better. Then the doctor said, unfortunately, she started to get better. The doctor couldn't believe it. She went through this chemotherapy. They had a mastectomy, took off one breast, took the chemotherapy and the lymph nodes, and she straightened, got better. And then the doctor said, unfortunately, we had to go in so deep she can never talk again, but we can get her one of these devices. And I said, Sandra, we got a speech teacher that works with people like you, and you're going to learn to talk all by yourself. And she went down there and thought she could and believed AA and her sponsor. And talked. In fact, they made tapes of her to play for the advanced cases to show that anyone can talk again after this if they believe strongly enough. And she lived. God, I gave her a fifth birthday cake and a sixth birthday cake and a seventh birthday cake, and she got sick and died from something entirely different. But I remember looking at her and thinking, God, I wish I had that much faith. She didn't have faith in an abstraction. She had faith because a sponsor, no matter who the sponsor was, she had some faith that the sponsor says it's going to be all right, and she thought it was going to be all right, so she got all right. Now, I'm not saying you can beat cancer by thinking it's going to be all right, but she did it. But I'm not in a mystic sense. I'm just saying that in a much lower sense or in a much less intense sense, that's what AA is about, and sponsorship, I think. There has to be someone that you will believe, even if you have to intentionally suspend your disbelief in order to do it. There has to be some place where you make the investment of your judgment. As you've been sober a while, it's just, I'll tell you, the relationship of a sick newcomer or a sick alcoholic to their sponsor many times, at least in the strong sponsorship areas, is very similar to a child with their parent. When they're new or little, their sponsor and or father is godlike. Oh. And you just, oh. And you stay sober a while or grow to be a teenager and you think, what's this dumb old son of a bitch doing? They're holding me back. I see truth now. His feet stink just like everybody else's feet. Then if you can survive that burst of wisdom, then you grow up and see your father or your sponsor for what he is, a human being who's been desired, who's been trying to help you. And you can get some relationship of adult to adult with a little degree of thankfulness from both sides. But usually it doesn't work that way. Usually in intense people, by the time you get to be a teenager, you run away from home. And that's all right, too. I noticed all these questions. Many of these questions on the slip Cliff provided today deal with how much is too much. I don't know how anybody can tell you that, because after you've sponsored people a while, you just have to almost do it intuitively. You have to try to see where they are, because people respond to different things. But I know this, unless the people I'm sponsoring, if they're not cross with me once in a while, I'm not doing a good job for them. Because that indicates I want to be their friend so much, I'm willing to buy their BS. And I want to do that. I think the greatest gift I got in early sobriety, and one that I try to transmit, although it makes me feel sad sometimes, I don't want to be people's friends so badly that I'll let them die in order to keep them disliking me by telling them what they don't want to hear. I've had many, many people I've sponsored over the years who have left shaking their fists and saying, "You son of a bitch!" And at first it almost killed me. Now it's just doesn't mean do much to me, except I wish I would have stuck around. But it's a funny thing I've discovered over the years. Whenever they get in trouble, wherever they may be, they call me and ask me, because they believe I will tell them the truth, and they're in bad shape. And that's really one of the best things you can engender, I suppose, and things we should work for. I can't always do it. I'm very weak and fallible in the area. But if I can leave a person I sponsor, they don't have to like me. They may be over in the next town bad-mouthing me. But I hope I've given them some respect, have some idea that they can respect my interest in them. And as they get to be sponsors, it looks different to them. It's just like the same way that, again, children. You never really understand that look on your father's face till you find it on your face looking at your own kids, you know. Oh, that's what he was thinking. A natural little son of a bitch. Sorry, Dad. And that's the way it's carried on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that some people, now, for instance, Chuck C. is a golden example. A man who stands at the podium, and rightfully so, and puts down sponsorship. He says, I never had a sponsor. I don't sponsor anybody. Which really is heartening to his babies. And people say, Chuck C. never had a sponsor. Why should I take that crap? I'll tell you why. Because Chuck C. has one thing happen to him that he's the only one I have ever known had happened to him. He was totally surrendered when he came to AA. He has never, according to his statement, never once again thought about a drink. Not very many people can make that claim. Maybe since noon, you know. I haven't thought about a drink for many years, but I thought of you. Most of us have to surrender little by little here. And our inclinations fight against it. And our obsessive behavior patterns come back. And our thinking and our resentments and our immaturities warp perspectives of reality again. Then I need someone who stands outside of my head and says, no matter how it looks to you, this is how it really is. And I got to believe him. I got to believe him even if I don't believe him. I got to, you know, it's the best analogy I know. I'm going to get done here. I think I said that same analogy here once at one of your intergroup meetings. But my perceptions of reality is, for instance, if my sponsor would say to me, that wall is blue, and I'd say, it isn't blue, it's yellow or off-white, it's not blue. It's blue! I said, I can't believe it. He said, you don't have to believe it. Just act like it's blue. You crazy old son of a bitch. I never said that out loud. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. But I acted like it was blue, and over a period of time, the wall turns blue. And then you can't understand insolent newcomers who think it's cream. Unfortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous is not made, life is not made up of colors of walls. I could do that realistically with the color chip. It's different colorations. It's the colorations of, but they didn't really mean that. The colorations of, why don't they like me? And my sponsor saying things like, I don't care how it looks to you, go and apologize to him, even though you're sure you're right. The colorations of, I don't care how it looks to you, don't quit that job today. Hang in there somehow. The colorations of, I don't care who hurt your feelings there, sit in that goddamn meeting tonight and act right. All the same things, like saying, the wall is blue. Colorations that when I'm in those moods, I cannot see and I can't believe, but I can act on. And as I act on them, the clear perceptions come back. That's why AA is called a program of action, not of thinking, not of mystic understanding, but doing things till the walls of your mind turn the color they really are. And when they dissolve again, having to perhaps go somewhere. That's why I have a sponsor today. I have a sponsor. I've called him every day for years and years and years. Not the same one. My first sponsor died drunk. It's a funny thing. He was giving me things to do just to keep me out of his hair. I did him. He didn't. I stayed sober and he died drunk. Isn't that funny? I think about that sometimes when I have an inclination to have still another sickie on the phone. No, no.
Yes.
But it isn't, it's almost what you're willing to do. I haven't had a problem for that sponsor for so many years. I haven't had a major problem with that sponsor for years. But if the day ever comes in which the world, there's no blue in the world, I want to have one person that I believe to tell me what to do. Because my perceptions will be so distorted, I can go through a list of names and they're all crappy. I want to have someone who's, even though he looks crappy, was all right last week somehow. And that's why I continue to do this, because I believe that people like us, if we knew what to do, we wouldn't be in AA. If our perceptions were all right, we wouldn't have to come here for help. And to come to AA and argue with help, that's the other thing. And there's a question there, and I'm going to sit down. There's a question there that says, should you have more than one sponsor? The answer in our pamphlet is, of course, you should have many sponsors. People like me should not have many sponsors. Because I will go to the one that will give me the answer I want that day. That's why I'm against mutual therapies, psychiatry and Alcoholics Anonymous. Not there's anything wrong with it, but you play them against each other like the child of divorced parents. I sponsor a psychiatrist. The first thing I had him do was discontinue his psychiatrist. He almost crapped. And I told him, it's nothing to do with psychiatry. It's something to do with my instinctive evasiveness in moments of crisis. I will play people against each other. I got to have authority, not even authority. I don't ask my sponsor what should do. I've been sober a long time, almost 25 years. I don't need to know, should I go to the meeting or read the book or do this or that? But I want to have a source out there when the time comes that it all goes to hell. I don't want to be the ultimate authority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to have just be one in the chain. And that's why I think sponsorship is such a valuable thing. It's also ideal to be a sponsor. Because you got to remember, just giving people information isn't enough. You must show them with your actions. And as you show them with your actions, you're doing things that you would think are no longer necessary. When people come down where I work and we go to lunch, we go outside to the light. It's a small thing. And there's a light there. You can go either way. No problem. I make that don't walk 9 times out of 10. But when I have a newcomer with me, I say, better wait for the walk light. I just act so goddamn good because I don't want them to turn out the way I turned out. But it's a mutually giving and sharing. And I think it's very similar, I would say, to a relationship of a daughter to a mother or a son to a father. There may be some veneration when you're new. You go through the wall of cynicism and doubt, and maybe you can wind up living together in sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. At least we'll all be here to try. Thank you.
I remember talking one time about the time that she was the sponsor of all the women in Southern California. All three of them, I think there were. And I'm not much of a hero worshiper, but I do have a heroine in the Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's Sybil.
Everybody, my name is Sybil Corwin, and I'm an alcoholic. And you can just betcha that I'm glad to be here. Before I start talking, Francis, I'm afraid you're going to have to come back up here a minute because I've got something here to give you. So this is like a little presentation. You remember our friend in Little Rock, Arkansas, by the name of Gene?
Yes.
Yes. All right, he mailed me this about 4 or 5 months ago, having heard that we'd be here today. And he told me to present it to you as if it was my gift to you.
Thank you.
He said that it had 24 holes in it, a silver dollar. The significance of that is you told him, or said so on a tape, that when you came to AA, you didn't think your life was worth a plugged nickel. And he said, tell Clancy that I think, and I know you think, that his life today is worth a plugged dollar. So he put 24 plugs in, one for each year, and he got your name.
That guy got an awful lot of juice for a lousy stinking dollar.
When he calls me this evening, I will tell him you said that. Now then, I sat there thinking of many things before the meeting started, and then when Clancy was talking about his life and the sponsorship, and particularly about the girl that had the operation, that I heard him tell that once before, and I was deeply moved. And I couldn't help but think that I have had a couple of very sad experiences, experiences that didn't turn out well. And I grieve over those things at the time. I was, many years ago, I separated from my husband and moved into a rooming house, room and board house, rooming house, a crummy room. And down the hall, there was a girl, and I noticed that the door would be open and she would be in bed. And then peeking in one day, I saw a lot of bottles, empty bottles. And I walked in, and she was in bad shape, and I talked to her. I didn't try to get her in AA. Obviously, she was a very, very sick woman. But I did sort of hang around with her during that week and got to know her pretty well. And she was terribly drunk all that time and wouldn't let me do anything about getting her in a hospital or anything else. And I had very little choice except to see that she had food, and I sat with her a lot. But she was so happy that her dad and mother were coming out from Iowa. She hadn't seen them in years. And she wanted to be sober when Daddy and Mama got there. And she talked about that quite a bit. And one night she was terribly sick, and my usual policy is not to buy a bottle for a drunk. And she hadn't allowed me to put her in the hospital or anything, but in this case, I did what she said. I went down to the corner liquor store and I got a half pint, because I had heard other members say there are times when a person has to have a drink or they may die. And I just didn't know what to do, and I did that. And I put the half pint there, and I went on to my room. And then in the morning, I went back to see how she was, and she was dead. Now, I didn't know what to do. I just didn't know what to do. And I went out to the hole in the ground, and I talked to Ray Walters and a few of the boys, and I was saying, I killed someone. I killed someone. And they said, no, you don't have the power to do that. That bottle that you left there was still there, and she was dying anyway, and you had no power over her life one way or the other. And I went back down to the rooming house, and I saw this little old couple come in, and they were looking at room numbers, Mom and Daddy, you know. And they were peeking at room numbers. Number four? No, she said number seven, or something like that. And that room was boarded up. The coroner's office had boarded it up. What could I do but walk up to them and say, your daughter is dead? It affected me deeply. Well, we know that alcoholics do die, and I had a right to feel bad about that, and I allowed myself that privilege. But there wasn't anything that I could have done to save her. And I expect that all of you who've been around Alcoholics Anonymous a while have regretted the fact that you've called upon someone who just wasn't that much interested in getting sober at that time. But thank God for one thing. In this town and in other towns that I've been in, I have had people walk up to me and say, you don't remember me. My name is Susie. You called on me, you know, X number of years ago, and I was drunk, and I called you up and gave you a good cussing and told you to get lost, but now I've been sober 3 years. And this story can be repeated over and over again. That some people come in too soon for some reason. Some people wait a while and they'll have a relapse because maybe they had to go because the judge said so, or their wife said so, or their husband said so. But in my experience, all the people, the true alcoholics, whether they turn us down the first time or the second time, I think they will come to Alcoholics Anonymous eventually, if they live. A lot of them die. And I'm so grateful that I'm here today, after 41 years of sobriety, and it's all been so good. Now, you see, I say that and I mean it, and you know darn well it hasn't always been roses and just beauty and wonder. I feel like it has every time I go to an AA meeting. And in between, I've had problems, and I've had grave problems. And I want to say right now, before I don't say it later on, because I wouldn't want to sit down without telling you that when I have a problem these days, and my sponsor is dead, and I only recently got a new one, Evelyn, at our central office, who used to work there for so many years, and she's my sponsor. But I want to tell you that in recent years, when I have been upset, and I get upset as a human being, I get upset, and I don't know which way to turn, and I don't know what to do, and my heart is filled with sorrow, I dial a number, and I ask to speak to Clancy Emmisler. And the reason I do that is because I know I can trust him. I think he is a friend of mine, and there isn't anything in the world that I would be afraid to tell him about my life, when it's good or when it's bad or when I need an answer. And I called him, two or three years ago. And when he answered, "This is Clancy Emmisler," I said, and I burst into tears, and there was a long silence for about 3 minutes, I guess. And then all of a sudden he shouted, "Did somebody die?" And I said, no. And then I told him what the problem was. I was terribly hurt. I'd gotten a letter from someone that I liked and loved very deeply. And the letter had been one of rejection and had called me some names and said, "Never, never, ever, as long as you live, get in touch with me in any shape, manner, or form, as long as you live." And I cried buckets full of tears. And I called Clancy and I said, "What am I going to do?" "Well," he said, "nothing today. I suggest you put the letter away for 30 days. And then at the end of 30 days, if you wish to answer it, you will know then what to say. Just put the letter away." I said, "Thanks, Clancy." And I hung up, and that's what I did. And I never found it necessary to do anything about the letter 30 days later. I mean, I just got a letter, that's all. Somebody didn't love me, obviously, and I was hurt. And that's the way it's been with me, and that's about Clancy. I'm a great admirer of his. Because I'm not the type... I can't be a tough sponsor sometimes when I ought to be. Frank Randall, my first sponsor, and Cliff Walker, but Frank Randall in particular, used to call me the sweetness and light division of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my brother Tex, he was the tough one. He could be tough or he could be gentle. And sometimes he had to be tough and gentle with the same person. But I always had this faith before Tex went to AA with me. I told him, I said, "I saw those people, Tex. I went down there, and there was just enough of them to fit around the table. Last week, I went down there. And I said, you know what? They're never going to drink again. They're in Alcoholics Anonymous." Tex said, "Oh, how naive can you get, Sib? I'll lay you 8-5 that half of them are drunk today." And I said, "Tex, don't talk like that about AA. Don't talk to me about AA like that, because I have faith in it. And I know it's got to work for me. I haven't got any place else to go or anything else to do, and they're sober. And they're going to tell me how to stay sober, and I'm going back. And I believe what they say." And I had that kind of faith when I came to AA, and I'm glad. Because I've been upset, and I've had tragedies happen. I mean, who wouldn't in 41 years? And AA has sustained me. And the people in it, when I've needed them, like I told you about calling Clancy. And the babies that I have worked with, and in the early days, as I pointed out, I was in charge of the women. They didn't let me be in charge very long because they didn't want to have someone in charge of them. But a strange thing about the early days, I forgot to mention that I came in March of 1941 off the Saturday Evening Post article. And I haven't had a drink since. I had my 41st birthday and haven't had a drink since. And I still like to sponsor people. I don't think there's ever a point where that you stop doing that. But at that particular time, they didn't have a female to handle the female calls on the women. And so they pointed at me and said, "And now we have a woman named Sybil. And Sybil, we're putting you in charge of all the women." I see you laughing. You reminded me of that before the meeting. And I truly thought I was. That meant that I had a little book. I had a book. And your name was in it. And you belonged to me. Because I was in charge. You called me, and I called you, and we met at the meeting, or I took you to the meeting, and I was in charge. And that, just nothing, department of my life, not knowing how to be in charge of myself. But the miracle of it was I stayed sober.
Go to tape. Go to tape.